Well, Michigan Congressman John Conyers, who is referred to as the Dean of the U.S. House of Representatives after John Dingell finally retired, John Conyers will serve one and possibly two more terms in Congress. Representative Conyers is 86 years of age. He told the Detroit News yesterday that he has, quote, plenty of energy, unquote, and vitality to serve another term in Congress, or maybe two. Easily, I've got the energy, he says. I've got a perfect bill of health, except for some high blood pressure I've got to watch. So he is kicking off his campaign for a 27th term in the U.S. House of Representatives. Conyers says, I'm in blessed health. He does have a challenger in the primary. Janice Winfrey, the Detroit City Clerk, is also in the Democratic primary. It's current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Ingham County officials recently decided to give taxpayers some of their money back. Late last month, the County Board of Commissioners approved Ingham's 2016 budget. It includes a reduction in the millage used to pay for the Ingham Health Plan. Now, recent projections underestimated the number of residents that would become covered by Obamacare and Michigan's Medicaid expansion, and the IHP's balance ballooned to about $10 million. Meanwhile, the county is also considering expanding a review into how contracts at the county are awarded following the firing of two employees in its IT department, Chief Information Officer Michael Ashton and IT Project Manager Frank Chain. Reportedly violated the county's code of ethics when they attended sports events and got other perks from a county vendor. For his views on both of these developments, we welcome back Chairman of the Ingham County Board of Commissioners, Brian McCrane. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me back.
This incident, or the incidents involving Michael Ashton, the head of the county's IT department, set several processes into motion. One was a Mason Police Department investigation. Has that determined anything that you can share with us?
That has not come back at this point, no.
Okay. When do you expect to hear back from the police department?
I'm not sure on the time frame of that, Mark.
Okay. Now, you wrote in a City Pulse piece that you need to understand how this happened and what steps need to be taken to prevent another. Is it clear to you, Brian, whether Mr. Ashton knowingly violated the county code of conduct? Is that clear, or was it a matter of ignorance here?
I think we saw some things that were troubling. As you know, there was a FOIA request that came our way as we were compiling that. We saw some things that were really concerning. We looked into them. We found reason for a reason to support our dismissal. So we were disappointed. It was information that caught us by surprise. I think people have indicated that there might have been rumors going around for a while about this. I think seeing something like this substantiated was troubling. So as we were compiling that request, we delved into it. We found troubling evidence, and we acted quickly. In fact, I think it was within a business day or two, that that investigation took place and that a judgment was rendered.
And the county has also launched a formal review of internal controls to determine if there is a need for systemic change. Anything to share on that front? What's going to be happening here?
Absolutely, and I don't think that we suspect anything. Certainly, we do operate a well-run government. We've never had this sort of thing happening before, but we do want to look into it, make sure that there are ways that we can detect these sort of things earlier. Certainly, having a Freedom of Information Act request come in is not the way that you want to come about this information. Certainly, you'd love to deal with it internally, but we're looking into ways that we could find out, how is this going on? Are these things going on? How would we find out sooner? How could we act sooner? And then, of course, we're looking at ways to just make sure that we're reminding people of our ethics policy, reminding people that this kind of behavior is not tolerated. We are a government entity. We just can't operate business like this. So we don't suspect that this stuff is widespread, but we're certainly taking actions to be proactive and make sure that people understand that it won't be tolerated and that there are consequences.
Is it your inclination to impose stronger controls?
We, through our County Services Committee, have been looking at a number of those things.
What might those look like?
We started right out of the gates with doing just training on our ethics policy and making sure that every department was reminded again of what we abide by. So we started with that. We're going to be doing some spot checking in some departments. Clearly, IT was in our focus. We did go back. We're starting to look at contracts. We've been looking at contracts. We've been doing a review. We anticipate that we may be doing that with other departments too as just a sort of an internal controls piece. But there's been a list of items and ideas generated by our committee, by our controller, and we're going to be exploring those as the next few weeks go on. Of course, we're coming into the holiday season. Our meeting schedule does taper off a little bit, but we expect to take this seriously, and we expect to take this into 2016.
Now, you wrote a column for City Pulse, which was the publication that filed the FOIA
Correct.
In the first place, and then you wrote a column for the City Pulse that involved a lot of what you've just already
Correct.
Shared with us here. Now, County Clerk Barb Byram responded to your column, also in the City Pulse, and she minced no words when she weighed in on this last week. She says there's no way the City Pulse story could have been the first time you or others in county government would have learned about this. I'll quote from the article here. On numerous occasions, I expressed serious concerns about unethical activity. Anyone who claims they were surprised was not listening or chose not to pay attention, unquote. Clarify for us, you're claiming that the first you heard about this was through the City Pulse FOIA, or after the City Pulse FOIA. Clerk Byram is strongly suggesting here that this was a topic of discussion prior to that.
The topic of discussion prior had been IT, the IT department's performance. The clerk was unsatisfied with a number of things in her office. She had brought those to our attention, just performance issues. And I'll tell you, with many of our departments, just in the past number of years, we've had a variety of budget cuts. And so I don't doubt that many of our departments are understaffed. But I would say I think we were monitoring that. In fact, our County Services Committee had been meeting quite frequently with our IT director, with Mr. Ashton, to address those performance issues. So performance certainly had been an issue. She was dissatisfied with the level of performance she was receiving, and we had been taking those issues seriously. I think in the City Pulse article, there had been it had revolved around one line at the end of one email in the midst of all of that performance review, which had suggested coincidence when a vendor had been in a meeting with IT staff. I think as I've reread that, and certainly we've seen these emails over and over, as I've reread that, I keep looking back and saying, what could I have read in there? Was there something that I wasn't seeing to see that there was one line in one email that talked about coincidence? I don't think that that's enough to have been a smoking gun. I think she was unhappy that a vendor had been in a meeting. And I think when I read it, I thought, we have a vendor at a meeting who's looking to deal with these performance issues, so we're just cutting to the chase. You know, I've looked back through those emails. I think a number of people looked through those emails. I didn't see any note of impropriety. So certainly, again, I think when this came out via the FOIA, which again was emails between, what was specifically requested was emails between our IT director and certain vendors. And it was in that these situations, these unethical situations were unearthed. So we had been serious about dealing with performance, and I think to confuse performance and being unethical is again confusion.
Hmm. She goes on to say that County Controller Tim Dolahanty is, quote, responsible for the activities of all county staff, unquote, suggesting, I guess, that he has not done his job. Is that worth looking into?
I think it would probably be the controller's opinion, and certainly mine, that we don't want to operate government or any business, any agency with an attitude of mistrust. Certainly this has made us all open our eyes, but I don't think it's healthy to be operating. I think you do have your employees and you trust that they're going to be behaving appropriately. And yes, of course, it's his responsibility. These are employees who report to him and through the IT director. But I don't think any of this was out in the open. And so I think, in fact, in some of these emails, there were mentions of, please don't say anything, don't say that, don't tell anyone. So I think there were some things that were being hidden. And like I said, I think this is now causing us to open our eyes. And again, I think this is a healthy discussion that we're having at the county to make sure that we're reminding people of our ethics policies, that we do take them seriously, and that we're going to be doing things to strengthen them in the future.
And the county, I understand, is hiring an outside auditor. Is that hire related to this, to these incidents?
Are you talking about the auditor regarding the health plan?
Well, that's why I'm trying to clarify. I know Mary Lanois, a former county employee, treasurer, I want to say.
Former county controller, yes. The Mary Lanois issue is actually related to the Ingham Health Plan, and I know we'll be talking about that next. But okay. I will be saying that there are a whole list of things, a whole host of ideas that we're considering, certainly bringing in fresh set of eyes, bringing in outside consultants or auditors to investigate some of these contracts is something that has been talked about.
Okay. Now, the county's relationship with the Ingham Health Plan has changed dramatically here in the past year or so. Voters just last November approved a new millage to pay the IHP to provide medical services for people who fall through the cracks. But over time, it was found that there were thousands fewer of these people in the post-Obamacare landscape. Then were projected, and a multi-million-dollar surplus accrued. The Board of Commissioners now has gone back and cut the millage and made that a part of the 2016 budget. It was getting $3.5 million a year after the millage. Do you know what the cut reduces that number to?
The cut should be reducing the millage to about $2 million.
Okay. And this is about $2 million a year coming in to pay for services for It's around 1,000 people from what I'm led to believe. Is that about right?
Well, and I'll actually clarify that a little bit, too. We cut it down from about $3.5 million to about $2 million. What we've also done as of recent, there's been some troubling developments in the state with funding for community mental health. And so the Board of Commissioners did make the determination, based on conversations, of course, that we've had, that mental health is a critical health service. So of that $2 million, we're actually splitting $1 million. $1 million will be the amount that's set aside for the Ingham Health Plan, and another $1 million will be set aside for mental health services through community mental health of Clinton, Eaton, Ingham for people that do qualify under the millage language.
And it will make clear that the Ingham Health Plan is an organization that contracts with the county administer these medical services. It's not insurance, and it's not a county department. And once they have the money, it's out of the county's hands.
That's
right?
Correct.
Right? Do they have, I mean, they ended up with quite a bit of public money that they didn't need, though. That seems to be the takeaway from this whole episode. Is that a fair way to assess this?
I would put it like this. I think that when I came onto the Board of Commissioners over 7 years ago, the Ingham Health Plan was serving over 10,000 people. It was a great program. I think commissioners throughout or since its inception have supported it, have been thrilled with it, have been eternally grateful that it's been able to serve the number of people that it has who were uncovered. The dynamic changed, the landscape changed so quickly after Obamacare, after the Affordable Care Act, and we had been very successful in this community and getting people onto other medical programs, onto Medicaid, onto Medicare, onto wherever they could get. We were very, very successful. And so I think we were so successful as a healthcare community that the numbers just tumbled. Yet the same amount of revenue was still coming into the plan. So yes, more money was coming in than was needed to support the rapidly dropping number. It does seem like the health plan has stabilized at around 1,000, though it's still a little bit tough to say where it's going to end up. I mean, there's still things changing. Of course, the national conversation seems like, you know, whoever comes in as the new administration could change things. I doubt it, but there's still some unknowns. So we think we're settled in around 1,000. It could be up to 2,000 at some point. But bottom line, it is a much smaller number. We want to make sure that these people are covered. The Ingham County Board has been very clear about making sure that we have coverage for everybody in our community to some degree. And we do see the health plan as a partner in doing that. So in looking at those numbers, we did realize that they'd shrunk. We did realize that the health plan had a fund balance, and we engaged in conversations over the past 6 months to really get a handle on that, get a handle on numbers, get a handle on costs, get a handle on the administrative overhead cost, which was a big sticking point for a number of us.
That was an issue. I know this was discussed. What is the health plan going to do with $10 million that it ostensibly appears not to have needed, though?
Sure. And of course, that's a discussion for their board of directors. Certainly, we were aware of that balance. There's nothing we can do. We don't have any recourse. We can't go ahead and grab it. But I think we did engage in a conversation with their board that said, if we wind up paying for the medical claims for the people on this plan, you've still got a budget. You've got staff. You've got overhead. You've got other things you're doing. You've got your internal IT or, heck, just even rent to pay for. And I think they've got relationships with a number of community agencies that they do support in terms of enrollment or providing service. So they have a much bigger budget than the up to $1 million we're going to be providing them. So I do expect that fund balance will be decreasing as they just operate over the next couple of years.
Well, what do you say to people who ask about the projections? I mean, clearly the projections were way off weren't they? I mean, your fellow commissioner, Randy Schaefer, commented this was, quote, the biggest fiasco we've ever had, unquote. Some number of people seem to think this got really screwed up. How do you respond to those people?
I think we all were disappointed that the numbers had dropped so quickly and that awareness of that came to us so late. As part of our discussion over the past 6 months, again, we really wanted to get a handle on those numbers. We wanted to talk projections. We wanted to talk numbers, how much it would take to operate this, who we're going to be serving, who are those people, what services. So we had a lot of behind-the-scenes conversations, a lot of committee work on this. I think our commissioners were very engaged in getting to the bottom of this. And as we move forward with the health plan, we are putting a contract in place. We realized we'd never actually had a contract in place with them, that this had just been sort of operating. You know, the money came in, it went to them, they were doing a good job. So we got serious about looking at this. We're talking about oversight issues too. And so you mentioned the Mary Lanois contract. We've been looking at ways that we can go in and make sure that only millage-eligible people are being served by the county's money. We've also taken strides to put our health officer on the board. She will be joining their board as we move forward. So I think it was a great opportunity to have discussion, to learn more, and again, to exert our oversight. Certainly, we trust we hope that the public trusts us. This is a lot of money coming our way, and we want to make sure that we're doing the best we can with these limited resources.
Well, do you fear that voters may be more wary of county millages in the future?
I think so, absolutely, and certainly that's something we'll be thinking about in the next couple of years as this moves forward. I'll tell you this: as we look to rewriting this when the time comes, all these issues are going to play out, and we'll certainly be thinking about what is the appropriate amount of dollar, who are the appropriate people served, and what is the whole millage eligibility piece, too? I think we were very restrictive in what we put out there. Personally, I'd be interested in seeing this maybe morph into a human services millage down the road.
We want to thank the chairman of the Ingham County Board of Commissioners, Brian McGrain. We've been talking about the future of the Ingham Health Plan and about the investigations into how to move forward with the county's code of ethics and contracts in the county. Brian, thank you.
Mark, thank you.
Coming up later in the hour here on Current State, we will check in with Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson about November's biggest environmental stories, including the legal consequences of Flint's water crisis and Michigan's stake in the upcoming Paris Climate Summit. Also, the sounds of 50 child dancers getting ready to perform at the Wharton Center this weekend. There they are, the Children's Ballet Theater of Michigan. Coming up on Current State, we'll speak with the longtime artistic director of the CBT, Gregory George, about the company's 35th anniversary year. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us today. You may know a lot about the great state of Michigan, but chances are there are places you haven't yet discovered. And if you want to learn more about what the state has to offer and perhaps be inspired to plan a trip to a Michigan city you've never explored, Under the Radar Michigan is the show for you. This Emmy Award-winning Michigan public TV show is currently in its sixth season on WKAR-TV, and it's hosted by native Michigander Tom Dalton.
I've been around the world, but there's one place I keep coming back to. And the more I explore, the more I realize it's the place to be. I'm Tom Dalton, and this is Under the Radar Michigan.
And Tom Dalton joins us by phone now. Tom, welcome to Current State.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. You know, it's really hard to say the sixth season. I always get tripped up when I say that.
A lot of S's there. You've said that Under the Radar was a show that was created out of adversity. Tell us what happened.
Well, boy, back in 2009, 2010, when the auto companies all crashed, I was producing car commercials. I was traveling around the country shooting the new Ford or GM, whatever, in the snow on the beaches and the, you know, with these big car shoots. And when the car companies had that big hiccup, I lost 90% of my income, went broke. I had a son actually at Michigan State University, a daughter in high school, and I thought, boy, I've got to like so many people in Michigan, I had to reinvent myself to survive at that time. And my good buddy Jim Edelman, he was head of national sales for a radio group called Clear Channel, and they laid off half their people nationally. So here we were, you know, two middle-aged guys sitting there after band practice one night, because we play in a band together as well, and we were like, what are we going to do? So we actually reinvented ourselves, came up with this harebrained scheme, presented it to PBS, and sure enough, it worked.
Put into words for us, Tom, you must really love Michigan to host a show about it here for so long. Put into words for us what you love about this state.
You know, I really have been around the world, and it's funny. I have a lot of friends who, you know, the grass is always greener. They move away, and they go around the country, around the world. But when it's time to get real, when it's time to have a family, when it's time to settle down, this is the place to be. It really is. I just love this state. Everything from the people here, the artists here, the food here, the natural resources here. We've got everything from mountains to the Great Lakes. We've got there's just so much natural beauty and so many wonderful people. I just can't think of a better place to put down roots than right here.
Is there a best-kept secret or two places you've discovered that not everyone knows about that's at the top of your list of Michigan's best-kept secrets?
Boy, it's funny. I've been doing this show 6 years now, and I am still discovering so many incredible things that I've lived here all my life, that I had no idea that some of these places are less than a tank of gas away from my house. One thing is it's hard to say, the Kitchitakippi Springs. Everybody knows about the Weekiwachee Springs in Florida, but we have what's called the Kitchitakippi Springs up in the Upper Peninsula near Manistique. You just go up, cross the Mackinac Bridge, turn left, and drive an hour and a half, and it's there. And it's this incredible natural freshwater spring that you pull yourself on this raft out in the middle of it, and at your 50 feet, the water is so clear and clean, it looks like you're floating on air. And this spring is full of what looked like prehistoric 4-foot-long trout. It's just one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. Another thing is Lake of the Clouds up in the Upper Peninsula, up in the...
Yeah,
I mean, I had no idea that some of the things that we have here, I had no idea the natural beauty that we have here.
We have a clip from an episode that shows another great, quote, secret spot, unquote. It's not necessarily so secret. This is from the episode you did in Porcupine Mountains Wilderness State Park when your guide, Bob, showed you the Presque Isle River. Let's listen.
Yeah. Now, when I say the UP is our own out west, the next place Bob took us proved that to be absolutely 100% true.
Okay, Bob. Why didn't you tell me you had waterfalls here, too?
It's kind of a well-kept secret here in the park. It's the very western end of the park, and this is the scenic Presque Isle River. It's a whole series of waterfalls and water slides surrounded by old-growth forest, fantastic geology. This place alone could easily be a park.
Well, that sounds like a beautiful spot, but I understand, Tom Dalton, you got into a memorable kind of pickle in the UP doing some diving near Marquette. Tell us about that.
Well, there's a park called Presque Isle Park that's adjacent to downtown Marquette. It's an island park. It's absolutely beautiful. And it's kind of a rite of passage for Northern Michigan University students to go out on what's called Black Rocks out there. It's a 20-foot high cliff, and you dive off this cliff into Lake Superior, which is probably about 50 degrees at the time we drove into it. And I thought, well, you know, gosh, if they can do it, I can do it. So I put on a Superman suit because I thought that would, lessen the impact and help me withstand the freezing water temperatures, which it did not. And all that happened was my Superman cape wrapped around my arm, and I had to swim with one arm 100 yards back to shore. But I survived.
Wow.
So
we're speaking with Tom Dalton, host of the Emmy Award-winning Michigan Public Television show Under the Radar Michigan. One of the things that makes the program fun to watch is the humor that you bring to this whole thing. We have a clip from the recent Best of Michigan Restaurants episode. This is at Hoffman's Deco Deli and Cafe in Flint. You're behind the counter helping them make food, and here you are with one of the chefs making a wrap.
Grab some cucumbers, a little bit of onion,
Now, either Heath is always this jovial, or I'm botching this wrap up something fierce.
Perfect.
There we go.
Now we gotta wrap it. You think you can wrap this thing?
Heck yeah, watch me wrap.
Pull the ends. Bring it down.
You better wrap this. Nobody's gonna eat this.
You're a guy who has fun at work.
Well, I honestly think the secret to the success of our program is we don't take ourselves too seriously. We have fun. We're not pretentious. We're not, we're just having fun. It's genuine discovery. I love people. I'm lucky enough to work with Jim Edelman and Eric Tremonti, it's three guys, two cameras, one car. We get in, we discover, we have fun. It's not about us. It's about the wonderful people, places, and things that we discover. So, again, we just don't, and I don't look smart enough to lie, and I'm not. So it really is genuine, honest, sincere discovery, And we just don't take ourselves that seriously.
You have been to the top of the Mackinac Bridge. You've flown in a tiny plane over Manistee. Is it fair to ask you for a single most memorable getaway?
You know, the UP adventures really are my favorite because they really are adventures. There's just pioneer spirit up there. There's 300,000 wonderfully creative, friendly people up there, and it's just a beautiful place. I think, actually, the one you mentioned, going to the top of the suspension tower on the Mackinac Bridge was, I will never forget that moment when I opened the hatch and stepped out there and thought to myself, how am I going to tell the guys I can't do this? But I noticed Eric, who has a little problem with heights, he was doing fine, so I thought, okay, just buck up and do it. But that will be probably one of the most memorable, looking down over, because we had a beautiful clear day, and you could see for miles, you could see the Upper Peninsula, Mackinac Island. It was just, it just drove home the majesty of Michigan for me.
Do you find all the locations for the show yourself? Where do all these ideas come from?
Well, when we first started the show, yes, we did a ton of research. I used to call CVB people and mayors of towns and a lot of internet research. Now our audience, we have the most loyal, engaged fan base that it's almost like an extension of our family. It's like we're all doing this together. We'll throw up on our Facebook page, you know, hey, we're going to the UP. What should we check out? And over the course of a day, we'll get hundreds of people saying, have you been to this restaurant? Have you taken this hike? Have you been to this hotel? So our fans on Facebook and our website are giving us so much to work with. It's humbling.
Do you think are you tempted to return to it? Have you returned to places yet? Or is there an impulse to always go someplace that you haven't been before?
Well, towns that have a lot going on, there's so many young people reconnecting with downtowns in this state right now because I think people want to belong. It's a sense of belonging and being a part of something. Lansing is a great example. There's so much energy pumped into that city from Michigan State University. So many young people are moving downtown. We go to large, like Lansing, we've been to a number of times. Detroit, we go back to a number of times. Grand Rapids, large metropolitan areas because there are so many young people doing so much cool stuff. We will go back to some large metropolitan areas, but we still like finding those out of the way, under the radar little nooks and crannies in the state that we don't all know about.
Under the Radar Michigan is an Emmy Award winner, a Michigan Public TV show currently in its sixth season. You can see it every week here on WKAR-TV, and it's been hosted by native Michigander Tom Dalton, who's been our guest. Continued success, Tom. Happy trails.
Thank you so much. I'll be out there. If you see me, wave.
All righty. Coming up on Current State, the aftermath of the Flint water crisis is still dominating headlines in Michigan. Most recently, state and city officials are being sued by citizens who say the lead-tainted water in their pipes caused serious health problems. We'll check in with Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson about that story and others for November's Great Lakes Month in Review. Plus, the Children's Ballet Theater of Michigan is celebrating its 35th anniversary of its production of The Nutcracker. We'll speak with the director and choreographer ahead of their Wharton Center performances coming up this weekend. Stay with us. It's Current State. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the end of each month, we check in with Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson about the biggest environmental stories around the basin. Today, we learn more about the continued fallout from the Flint water crisis, Grand Rapids Mayor George Hartwell's planned trip to the upcoming Paris Climate Summit, and two Michigan senators' push for pipeline protections. Gary Wilson, are you there?
Yes, sir. Good morning and early happy Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And back at you. The water crisis in Flint continues to make headlines. Over a month after it was first discovered that old pipes were leaching lead into the city's drinking water. Now, one of the latest developments involves two lawsuits filed against state and city officials. Gary, talk to us about these two lawsuits. Who are bringing these?
Sure, Mark. And, you know, given the magnitude of the problems that Flint has been experiencing, you know, people have been telling me it was all but inevitable before some groups of people would take legal action. Two prominent national advocacy groups, Natural Resources Defense Council and the American Civil Liberties Union, have filed their notice of intent to sue Flint and the state of Michigan for violations of the Safe Drinking Water Act. That's the law that the federal law that governs this. In the second suit, a group of Michigan law firms has filed a suit on behalf of citizens in Flint against the state of Michigan, city of Flint, and a number of state employees, including by name Governor Snyder and by name Dan Wyant, the director of the Department of Environmental Quality. They allege that the defendants here, and I'm quoting from the press release brought by the released by the lawyers, that their clients were endangered. The health of the clients was endangered by the exposure to lead tainted drinking water. And this suit also is going to seek class action status. So the stakes are a bit higher here.
Well, what would it accomplish if the environmental organization, the Natural Resources Defense Council, were to succeed in court?
Well, the remedy in their case is what's called injunctive relief, which in plain speak means it wants a court to order the defendants, Michigan and Flint, essentially to fix the problem. That is, provide safe drinking water, water that doesn't have lead and the other harmful contaminants. The two groups went to court because they say over a period of time that Michigan and Flint knew of the problems and didn't take action. You know, court legal action is always the last resort, and they think it's warranted in this case.
We'll talk a little bit more about this ACLU suit here in just a minute. I'll ask you first, though, that Michigan has taken steps to address what went wrong in Flint. Governor Snyder has appointed a task force to investigate what happened and make recommendations to avoid a similar situation in the future. How have the NDRC and the ACLU responded to the Snyder administration's actions so far on this issue?
Well, Mark, it comes down to trust. I talked to Josh Mogerman yesterday, the national media director for Natural Resources Defense Council, and he said that Michigan and Flint still have a lot of work to do on Flint's water issues. You know, next year they have to go through this all over again because that pipeline directly to Lake Huron will come online. And Mogerman said that with Michigan's track record of denial of the problem early on and then inadequate action, they feel a court order is needed to make sure Michigan and Flint get it right this time.
We're talking with Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson about the lawsuits against the state and city officials in the aftermath of the Flint water crisis, as well as this month's other big environmental stories. Now, the second lawsuit involves several Flint families who say that the tainted water led to health problems ranging from hair loss to hypertension. What are the families involved in this lawsuit? What are they asking for?
Well, the families want compensation for physical injuries and for damage to their property. And perhaps even more important, they want a lifetime of medical monitoring of the children exposed to the lead tainted water. These young children who are being exposed, you know, will carry this risk for the rest of their lives. So that last request is a big one, the provision of medical monitoring for the children.
The attorneys in the case are seeking class action status, which would mean that anyone who is exposed to lead could also seek damages if the lawsuit succeeds. What has to happen for a lawsuit to include thousands of people exposed to lead tainted water who are not named in the lawsuit right now?
It's a pretty straightforward process. The lawyers would have to petition a judge to certify that the suit has met the criteria for class action. Given the numbers, I'm not an expert on this, but given the numbers of people potentially impacted in Flint, I suspect, in the egregious nature of what's happened there, I suspect that they'll be certified as a class. You never know what a judge is going to do, but that's my take.
Mm. Well, moving from Michigan news to a story that's about as global as it gets, I mean, the Paris Climate Summit kicks off next week, and leaders from all over the world will gather to discuss a strategy for combating global climate change. And one of those leaders will be outgoing Grand Rapids Mayor George Hartwell. Gary, what will Mayor Hartwell be doing there?
Yes, Mayor Hartwell is going to Paris along with a couple of other mayors, including Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, to attend the climate summit. And they'll be representing the interests of Great Lakes cities. I had an exchange yesterday with David Ulrich, who runs the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, of which Mayor Hartwell is, and Grand Rapids have been longtime members. And Ulrich said that the mayors are attending because they see cities as being on the front lines of climate change. And when in Paris, Mayor Hartwell and his colleagues are going to be focused on demonstrating what cities are already doing, Great Lakes cities are already doing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and also sharing their hope and concern that at the highest levels of for the bigwigs who are going to be there, that they need them to support the local actions. The second part of it is they're going to be talking about the need of cities near waters to focus on resilience and adaptation in the absence of any success at controlling greenhouse gas emissions. And this relates to cities' ability the ability of cities to deal with their municipal water and sewer systems for the expected increase in storms that will take place if we don't get a handle on the climate change issue.
During his long term as Grand Rapids mayor, Mr. Hartwell's been vocal on environmental issues, and he was also recently appointed to a White House task force on climate change. What kind of environmental legacy do you see George Hartwell leaving when he exits office at the end of the year?
Well, Mark, Michigan should be proud of Mayor Hartwell. I've followed his environmental career for over 10 years now, and he's going to leave Grand Rapids with an impressive environmental legacy. Before it was popular, he embraced the need to restore the Great Lakes and to take action to protect the vulnerable cities in the region. And he's gone beyond Grand Rapids. He's become a regional leader on environmental issues, and I think that's because he realized that if you're going to have healthy cities, you can't do it over the long term without a healthy environment. So I think his environmental legacy is cemented for the future.
We're talking with Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson about the lawsuits against the state and city officials in the aftermath of the Flint water crisis, as well as other big environmental stories from this month. One of them involved Asian carp. It's in the news again after the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced that the invasive fish has made its way closer to Lake Michigan than before. What do we know about this latest development?
Yes, Mark. This involves that recent Fish and Wildlife Service announcement that they've discovered a couple of juvenile carp, juvenile defined as fish about 6 inches in length. They've discovered them much closer to Lake Michigan than they previously were thought to be. Now, there's still 75 miles of water between these fish and the electric barrier that's designed to keep them at bay, keep them out of Lake Michigan. But the concern is, and it has been a long-time concern, is that it may be easier for the juvenile fish versus the big 80-pounders to traverse the locks and dams and possibly even the electrical barrier. That's why the alarm bells went off again.
Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow is calling on the Obama administration to take immediate action to address the threat of Asian carp making its way into the Great Lakes. Are we likely to see any more action from the feds on this, given this development?
I doubt it, Mark. You know, there's a bit of a dance that goes on here, and it seems to happen about twice a year. And I don't mean to make light of it, but I've seen it play out many times. There's an announcement of, like the one that we just talked about, of an increased threat from Asian carp. But the Obama administration says, especially via the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Army Corps of Engineers, they've got an effective plan in place. Senator Stabenow and others want more and quicker action the press releases fly from both sides, and it fades away until the next time. It reminds me a little bit of the character from Greek mythology, Sisyphus. You know, he pushed that boulder up the hill only to have it roll down, and then he would do it all over again. That seems to be our plight with some of these Asian carp stories. So we'll have to see.
We've been talking about November's biggest environmental news stories with Great Lakes commentator and journalist Gary Wilson. Thanks for joining us, Gary. Always informative.
Thank you, Mark. Take care.
And this segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. It is time for Current State Staff Music Pick of the Week, and Scott Pohl has it covered this week. What do you have for us, Scott?
Well, Mark, I want to introduce you to a new 2-CD set called Dylan Cash and the Nashville Cats. It documents how Bob Dylan's decision to record Blonde on Blonde in Nashville in 1966 led to a friendship with Johnny Cash and inspired musicians from the rock and country worlds to work together. Artists like Flat and Scruggs, The Byrds, Kris Kristofferson, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr are heard on this set. Listen to a bit of the final track, Matchbox, from the TV show Johnny Cash hosted at the time. His guests were the legendary Carl Perkins and Eric Clapton, so they jammed together.
I'm sitting here wondering, will the matchbox hold my clothes?
I'm sitting here wondering, will the matchbox hold my clothes?
Matchbox featuring Eric Clapton's band Derek and the Dominoes with Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins. Find it on Dylan Cash and the Nashville Cats. Thanks, Scott.
Enjoy.
Well, Friday night, after stores are picked clean of their wares, 50 or so dancers will assemble on stage at the Wharton Center in East Lansing. It's the start of 3 days of performances of Tchaikovsky's classic Nutcracker Ballet by the Children's Ballet Theater of Michigan. And Current State's Jamie Paisley joins me now after speaking with the company's artistic director and choreographer this past weekend. Hi, Jamie.
Hi there. Yeah, a little bit of the audio from that rehearsal that we're hearing right now. I will say that dancing Friday through Saturday sure would be a nice way of working off those extra calories from Thanksgiving dinner, right? And in speaking with Gregory George and attending one of those final rehearsals before they take the stage at the Wharton Center, it was readily apparent that there's a great intersection of talent and dedication for these productions. But with something as well-known as the Nutcracker, how does the Children's Ballet Theater artistic director make this production his own?
In many ways, it becomes the dancer's own ballet, and that's how I've been raised. I do change the Nutcracker every year. Maybe 45 to 50% of it is changed. In Nutcracker, the original Nutcracker production, there is no prologue, and I put a prologue in, and that just gives dancers a further opportunities to dance and perform. And then I add dolls. Typically in Nutcracker, there's a Nutcracker doll, a ballerina doll, and a Harlequin and Columbine. And of course, each year I add different dolls. We've had this year there's a mirror doll, which is really kind of cool, and a rat doll. And sometimes I've had baseball players or a bear rug that comes to life, a suit of armor, which was actually quite fun. So we do different things, and I kill the rat differently each year.
For CBT's artistic director and choreographer, Gregory George, those variations on the theme of Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker comes from the abilities of the dancers themselves and whatever skill sets present themselves each and every year.
I'm kind of a shoot-from-the-hip kind of guy where I wait until I actually get all the dancers in the room and we have callbacks, which means the dancers all come back after Nutcracker. We come back in the spring in January, and I'll look at the kids and then I'll change my direction just a tad on what I see. Some of these kids go away and study and they get better, and then my whole chemistry sets in and that's the direction I go in. So I don't try to pre-plan a whole lot. That's the way I work. Some people have to pre-plan, but I don't.
This 2015 season marks a rather important year in the life of the Children's Ballet Theatre of Michigan, or CBT.
Well, it's an anniversary year for CBT. It's 35th anniversary, so 35 years. And luckily and honorably, I've been involved for the past 18 years. I've been raised like old school. I've been in the ditches, so to speak. I started when I was 7 years old dancing. I became professional at age 16. Finished high school and then toured and did the whole mecca. But I was trained to do the stage setup, help with the lighting, do the sounding. And when you have to do all that, tear it back down, load the truck, and go on to the next place, you have a much greater appreciation of what is required and what artists have to do and should know to do.
And for this season, Gregory George has quite a number of dancers to coordinate as choreographer for this weekend's Nutcracker at the Wharton Center.
This year's estimated 50, and then we have approximately 6 male guest dancers that come and join us. We do have 2 smaller gentlemen in the company, and they're just not quite old enough or technically proficient enough to handle some of the other roles that we need. Once they're into the company, they elect to stay as long as they want. And so at age 8, they're eligible. At 18, when they've graduated from high school or have reached the age of 18, they then become alumni, and some go on to dance further at colleges and universities.
Now, after 35 years, quite a large number of children have plié'd through the studio of the Children's Ballet Theatre. And during this anniversary year, there is a gathering planned for CBT alumni ahead of one of the upcoming post-Thanksgiving Nutcracker shows.
Yeah, Friday around 5:30, we have invited as many of the alumni that could come back or that we had contacts for. And there's literally hundreds of alumni dancers that have gone through CBT since I've been here. 18 years of saying 30 to 50 dancers, and they some of them stay quite long. But the girls that come back, it's so much fun to, you know, some of them are lawyers and doctors, and it's pretty cool. Some of them have continued dance. And when we get them all back together, we reminiscing, just like Thanksgiving, you know, it's what it's about.
As was readily apparent during the rehearsal I attended, there is a great number of kids around with various levels of personal restraint, let's say. And to keep things running smoothly, CBT uses an all-volunteer army of help.
In Children's Ballet Theatre, which is a nonprofit-based ballet company, we only have 2 paid people, and one of which is the artistic director, myself, and then we have a ballet mistress / repetitor that is in charge of rehearsing the dancers. After the choreography has been implemented, then we turn it over and she cleans it up a little bit, and then we get ready for presentation. But as far as the costuming, the props, marketing, we have a dancer management that takes care of internal grievances and things like that. It's all volunteer. So we figured out 1 year for Nutcracker, it's 4,000 plus hours of volunteer work, plus, of course, my time.
Now, when it comes to the opening night on Friday with 50 children at various levels of nervousness, will CBT's artistic director, as well as Nutcracker choreographer Gregory George, be herding cats, or in the case of the Nutcracker, herding rats?
Well, you know, there's a buzz. There's a certain buzz that happens every show. But opening night is just a little bit sometimes a little tempers flare and the stress level goes up. But yet, when that music starts, it all calms down and people just do their jobs and do them well. And then we have a great collaborative experience that is always different for every show. It's not like a DVD that you put on and it's always the same. And live entertainment is live. So anything can happen, but that's why we do it. There is a lot of responsibility, and again, most audience goers, when they sit and watch a show, there is a certain amount of envious that sets in with these people saying, gosh, I wish I could be on stage, or I wish I could feel that. And then on the flip side, the dancer's saying, wow, I wish I could be sitting in the audience because I'm really nervous right now. So it goes both ways, but we would never give it up.
The Children's Ballet Theatre of Michigan arrives at the Wharton Center stage for Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Friday and Saturday night at 7:30 p.m. and also has a Sunday matinee at 2 p.m. Tickets and more information at cbtdance.org.
Good job.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Glad you could join us. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, 3 weeks ago, Dr. Karen Williams Weaver made history when she was elected the first female mayor in the city of Flint. The psychologist turned public servant has no shortage of issues to deal with, lead-tainted drinking water among them. We'll talk with Flint's new mayor about all these challenges. Plus, Michigan's first cat cafe has opened its doors, and it's about time, isn't it? The Ferndale Cat Shelter and its furry residents have taken up in a storefront where you can now enjoy coffee and tea while you snuggle up to some feline friends. We'll talk with the shelter's volunteer coordinator, Deanne Iovan, about the cat phase first weeks in business. And that and more tomorrow here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, April Van Buren, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. Don't forget our podcast. Get the latest Current State delivered straight to your smartphone every day. Just subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. We're on Facebook. Current State from WKAR is the address. I'm Mark Bayshore. See you tomorrow on Current State.